Maxim.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Years ago, city officials brought an internationally known architect to town, eager to show off our rapidly growing uptown area. What we got from that architect was both a slap in the face and a wake-up call. What we had created, at least as seen through the eyes of this respected architect, was a soulless, glorified office park, alive, barely, by day, and dead by night. A city of buildings whose walls soared to the sky while closing themselves off from the people on the streets and creating an atmosphere that simply wasn't inviting, certainly not on a human scale. Charlotte is not a city to take something like that lying down. Officials immediately got to work to rectify their mistakes. In the intervening years, great strides have been made to create a memorable urban experience. The grouping of museum buildings on South Tryon, which opened back in 2010, was a step in that direction, particularly the Beckler Museum of Modern Art and its building. Its innovative design brightens the streetscape, warms the heart, and speaks dramatically of a city with dreams, all while beckoning people to come inside. After all, if the outside is so spectacular, what treasures must the building hold? That building is the work of internationally acclaimed Swiss architect Mario Botta and is only the second public building of his design in the United States. As the museum readies an exhibit of Botta's landmark work from around the world, we're going to spend this hour talking about the contributions architecture and design can make to the texture and character of a city. And we're joined by John Boyer, president and CEO of the Beckler Museum of Modern Art. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. David Walters is an architect and senior urban designer with the Lawrence Group and a professor in the urban design program at the College of Arts and Architecture at UNC Charlotte. Welcome back as well.
Nice to be here, Mike.
And our other DW, David Wagner, is a principal at Wagner Murray Architects. Mr. Wagner has designed several landmarks in Charlotte, including the Green, the Levine Museum of the New South, 7th Street Station, help me out here, Bank of America Stadium.
It's a pretty good list.
It's a pretty darn good list, actually. Thank you for being here. And you played a role in the design of the Beckler, working with Mario Botta.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Arguably, as I've said, the Museum of Modern Art building, the Beckler, is among, if not the most distinctive buildings in the city of Charlotte, and that's thanks to Mario Botta, I would think, but we'll find out in a second. Since this is only his second building in the United States, public building in the United States, how did he come to be chosen to design the Beckler?
That's a great question. And I think that David Wagner, more than anybody, has got a granular sense of that history. But the short version is that in the beginning, Andreas Beckler and his advisors imagined everything from an international competition of architects of all stripes, an international competition of architects who were junior in the field. But literally, Andreas would tell you that it came to him in a dream that it should be Mario Botta. They had met, but were not close friends, but they had a shared network of artists and other friends. And principal among those, of course, would be Nicky de Saint Phalle, the sculptor who did the fabulous Firebird out in front of the museum, because Mario had worked with Nicky on what's known as Noah's Ark, a fabulous sculpture park in Jerusalem. And also Mario had designed the Tanguy Museum, which is dedicated to the wonderful career of Jean Tanguy, who, of course, has much work in art collection and also did the great Cascade sculpture in the Carillon building, commissioned by the Beckler family. So because of these two links between Jean Tanguy and Nicky de Saint Phalle, Andreas thought it would be really important to have a conversation with Mario, and one thing led to the other.
And David Wagner, you had done some architecture work for Andreas Beckler at his home and other places. Did you? What role did you play in both helping Mario Botta with the Beckler design and construction, but also did you play a role in choosing him? I mean, he could have chosen you to do the building. I mean, if you can do the Bank of America Stadium, you can certainly do the building, right?
That's true. I could have, but I deferred to Andreas Beckler on that. But nonetheless, I've known Andreas for a number of years. As a matter of fact, I met him in the early 70s when I arrived in Charlotte as a much younger architect. And over the years, did work on a few projects with Andreas when he was chairman of Pneumophil. He had a group of corporate buildings here in Charlotte. And a number of other things. We just stayed closely in touch over the years as good friends. But But with regard to the museum, I was we acted as architect of record, which is different than the design architect. So think about it in movie production, there's a director and a producer. So you can think of our firm as the producer. And architects of record basically put the building together. We produce the product. Mario does the design. We take the building that he has come up with, the vision, and we put it together, mechanical, electrical systems, structural systems, all those things, and then we put it together and put it out to bids. So we produce the project in tandem with Mario's office as he was sending drawings over to us electronically, of course. We would convert them from metric to standard, and then we would get them out to the contractor.
And when you see a building designed like that, what was your first reaction to the building when you saw the design on paper?
Well, I thought it would end up being a remarkable product for the simple reason that Mario is a true builder in the sense of a traditional architect, much like Frank Lloyd Wright in our country would be considered a true builder. Mm-hmm. He's very material sensitive. So we had to assemble this building in sort of Mario terms, how the walls came together, the precision with which Rogers Builders, the contractor, put it together, and our hats off to them. They did a terrific job. And most unique about the project, in which is what I think most people recognize immediately, is the clay tile on the exterior.
Which I want to talk about as we go through the program. This is part of a cluster of buildings. For people who don't come downtown very often, this is part of a cluster of buildings on South Tryon that really has just dramatically changed the city in that area, the city. And you walk into that area or you drive into that area and you pray that the rest of the city is going to be that good. but when that cluster of buildings was put together, and that includes the Duke Energy Tower, the Mint Museum, the Knight Theater, your building, the Beckler Museum of Fine Art, and I guess the Harvey B. Gantt Center, which is across the street.
Oh, yes, yeah.
When that cluster was envisioned, was that the way it was envisioned? Or did it kind of come together piecemeal, the Mint with their own ideas, the Performing Arts Center with their own ideas, you with your own ideas?
Well, you know, there was a general sense of this combination of Main Street retail, commercial office towers, and these cultural apparatuses. And I think what makes this complex so remarkable is the achievement of having all these different architects work together, in effect. So each one of the cultural entities had their own architectural firm, and this was all overseen principally by Wachovia, now Wells Fargo. They were really the generator, the true developer of this project, in tandem with the city and other supporters, of course. And you're really talking about 4 acres and almost over $800 million worth of capital investment. But it is – and one of the reasons why this complex is so admired, not only across the country but now around the world, is that you had public-private partnerships, commercial, retail, and cultural all working together on budget, on deadline. It is a great, great story for the city to tell.
We've talked about architecture and urbanism with you, David Walters, many, many times in the past. And this, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, is a great example of what you're talking about when we talk about these things, among other things.
It's always a pleasure to go down there. You're exactly right. The one thing that hasn't been mentioned, which was there in advance of the museums but plays a vital part, is the green. And I know, David, you had a role to play in that as well.
That's the little park out in front of the
Radcliffe. That's the little park with the public art scattered through. There's St. Peter's Catholic Church on one side and another little mixed-use building. And then there's the mid-rise apartments on the other side. Right. So that's an urban open space with the convention center at the back, and then the Beckler faces directly onto that space. And so it's not just that the Beckler fits beautifully on Tryon Street. It's the fact that it's the jewel at the end of the park. Mm-hmm. And the extent to which that all happened or was really designed, I don't have any insight on that, but however it arrived, it's a beautiful ensemble.
Well, originally, the Beckler was supposed to face south, and Mario Botta made the decision to put the entrance on South Tryon. Is that correct?
Well, good Lord. In fact, there's a longer story, too, but we'll get to that in a second. In fact, remember, the museum was originally going to be built on property that Andreas owns outside of the city.
Right.
So it was a big enough decision to bring all of this into this larger campus.
With a completely new design.
Completely same architect, same patron, same collection, but a dramatically different design because the context was so profoundly different than the 300 acres of pine and hemlock and a mile and a half of shorefront on the Catawba River. Instead, now Mario is faced with this wonderful opportunity in an urban setting. And so David knows better how this thing's kind of twisted around on its axis.
All right. Well, there's a backstory first, Mike, and I just want to touch on this a moment. David mentioned this, but the backstory is that this all was a result of Ed Crutchfield's vision, believe it or not, who was
from First Union.
From First Union, and what Ed particularly did not like was above ground parking decks, and this prompted him to get his lieutenant in charge, Pat Mumford, to look for ways to develop a plan in the South Tryon district, competitive, of course, with the North Tryon, but nonetheless, the idea is to consolidate open space and connecting space and to make a, if you will, a true urban vision. Well, it all started with, well, what do we do? Well, let's put the parking deck underground, which was, as you would expect, four or five times more costly than putting it above ground. But as a result of putting it below ground, we were able to put the green on top of it, which was a suggestion during the design process. Pat Mumford orchestrated this very well. We made the park, connected it to the convention center, and then to Tryon Street, with the belief that this park would be the segue, if you will, or the catalyst to future development whenever it would occur. Now, Ed Crutchfield didn't envision the three museums and the tower and so on, but he did say, if we can connect all this together, maybe in the future this could happen. Then Ken Thompson came in subsequent to Ed's departure, and he realized this vision with Pat. So that's the backstory of how the green got there, and as a result, as David said, the green was the catalyst to connect the master plan to the remaining part of South Tryon.
I want to hear from the two architects at the table here about why that space feels so good when you're in the middle of it.
It's a mixture of scale, which is not quite the same thing as size. You know, it's how big the space feels or how small or whatever. It's a combination of a good human scale. You feel at home there, whether you're under the colonnade or in the park or even on the sidewalk. So then there's the mixture of uses. You know, there's religious, there's cultural, there's housing, there's retail. So people are using that space on different schedules at different times of the day for different purposes. And then when you get those two things working, the catalyst is the quality of the design. And we've been incredibly fortunate that each one of those components has been very well designed in itself. Mm-hmm. And I don't think any of the designers or the people, the developers or the people behind the scenes have had this issue of big ego wanting to be, this is about me. And so without that aggression, that compatibility literally allows people to use the space how we want to.
And all of those projects have a very different look, a very different feel. They were not cookie cutter. They don't all look the same. And they could easily have said, well, we'll just make the Mint look like the Beckler or the Beckler look like the Mint and the Knight Theater will look like that and it'll all be one big complex. But it doesn't. They're all completely different.
Right. And oftentimes, at least in the 60s and 70s, you typically selected one architect to design a complex of buildings. That was not the directive here, but picking up on what David said, everything he said is absolutely dead on, but not to turn this into a tutorial, but I think that you asked the question of why is it so successful, and I would tell you there are three reasons, and we'll pick up in a second.
Exactly right. We'll get to those reasons in just a moment. Already he's hosting the show. David Wagner is a principal architect with the Wagner Murray Architects. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Theater Charlotte, presenting the Miss Firecracker Contest. A small-town girl participates in a 4th of July beauty pageant, hoping to salvage her reputation now through February 9th, carolinaticks.org. And Mr. Rogers Windows, a local family business since 1986, offering renewal by Anderson replacement windows and entry door systems installed by trained craftsmen. Product details at mrrogerswindows.com. Inventions are the things that change the world. The wheel, the plow, the telephone, the steam engine.
radio, television, the internet. It's all changed the world and how we lived. And Discovery Place is opening an exhibit about the 101 inventions that changed the world. Some of their choices are obvious. Others may surprise you. We'll hear about those inventions and look at how the process of inventing has changed over time Monday on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. President Obama takes his State of the Union message on the road. The House approves the Farm Bill, and the Fed continues its stimulus cut as Ben Bernanke's term ends.
Join the conversation on the News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the urban design and the texture of a city being given to it by its buildings and how they sit on the land and what they're made of and what they look like and how they're designed to work together or not with John Boyer, who's the president and CEO of the Beckler Museum of Modern Art. The reason we're having this discussion is because the Beckler is bringing Mario Botha to town today to speak. He was going to be a guest on this program, but he does not speak English. We thought that would be a little cumbersome. So
it takes twice as long, I can tell you.
It does. But Mario Botha, Architecture and Memory, is an exhibit that the Beckler is opening today. I believe it's today. And runs through July 25th at the museum, which we'll talk about. David Wagner is also with us, principal with Wagner Murray Architects, who helped build the building that Beckler is in. And David Walter is a professor of urban design and an architect himself with the Lawrence Group and with UNC Charlotte. So you were going to talk, David Wagner, about the three principles of why the buildings on that site feel so good.
Well, I think there's a lesson here. And the notions, put very simply, are, first of all, David mentioned it, it's context. And I think context is a natural resource that we hunger for and we squander regularly when we build cities. And what's so important about this project is we have created a center. It has a context. As David said, it relates to all the other buildings, the existing buildings that were there, the connection to the green. This is just straightforward, great urban design. The second thing I would mention regarding the building, particularly the museum, is this is an age-old idea. It's an eternal maxim that vantage is very important in architecture. And the reason the Beckler is so successful, and for that matter the entire project, is two things have to happen. A great building or great place has to look great from a distance and close up. And you've traveled all over, Mike, and you know, looking at a Gothic building, or the Greeks knew this, the Romans knew this, their buildings work from far away and they work close up. So as you approach this complex, you get a sense of comfort, like you belong to it.
How do you do that in a contemporary American city, which seems to be built on and this is happening around the world now, the idea is to be really, really, really tall. So you have this magnificent skyline. When you're approaching New York City from the Jersey Turnpike,
fantastic.
It's a beautiful view. It's gorgeous. It's remarkable. But, you know, you get into the city itself and all the interest is up top, 50 stories.
Well, not necessarily. I think that tall buildings are important to cities. Without tall buildings, you wouldn't call it a city. You would call it a much smaller.
So how do you take those big
buildings? Because you create a datum line. And what's so great about this project, it creates a datum line, which is essentially the height of the Beckler, the height of the Knight Theater, and the height of the Mint Museum and the Gantt. They reach a height of approximately 50 to 60 feet, which creates an imaginary line that your line of sight is contained. Anything above that is fine. You have, again, back to the two vantage points. Does it look good close up? Yes, it does. Does it look good far away? Yes, it does. So I think that has a lot to do with your normal perception of space. You have a tendency to enter that space and not look up. You tend to look down.
Yeah, there's a basic maxim of architecture and urban design, which, as David suggests, in the sort of modernist period that we were trained in, we were taught to forget this. But all architectural generations before had regarded buildings as being in three parts: a base, where people walk by, a middle, and a top. The top is what you say when you look at the view of Manhattan. Mm-hmm. The middle of the buildings we generally don't look at very much.
Right.
And, you know, that's where things get more or less the same from floor 6 to floor 30. Right. And the bottom of the buildings, which is what we've relearned, is that that's where we pay special attention. And all the buildings, you know, the Beckler, the Mint, the Gant, every piece of that, even the giant tower, pay attention to their bottom story, what we call the pedestrian level. So the pedestrian experience is rich.
And this
all the
is
way
one
around.
Of the things that the architect I alluded to in the opening of the program observed about Charlotte, and which we have agonized over, that there is no retail on the first floors of anything. So there's nothing to see. And a lot of the buildings that came up in the 80s and 90s in the city not only had nothing to see, no retail, there were no windows. I mean, you had just a slab of concrete at the sidewalk. So it's completely uninteresting and uninviting.
Interesting to note this, Mario Botha made this comment about this complex. He particularly admires the way all these buildings have come together. He doesn't say one is better than the other, but he says in context it's very European. And if you ask him why, he says because if you look at old European cities, they were created without a plan. The one building related to the other because of a multitude of reasons. But small European cities, even larger ones, have great urban space because it weaves in and out. It's not a straight line. It's omnidirectional. And he really enjoys the way these buildings have come together. He finds this a very pleasing composition.
The building itself, though, the actual Beckler Museum, if you know nothing about architecture, it doesn't take a genius to see that building from any vantage point and know that it is special. There's something about that building that is significant, and it's become significant to the city and the region. So put it into – how would you rank it? I mean, in buildings in the city, buildings around the country, because it's unique. How would you rank it?
Difficult question to answer. If you're ranking it in terms of what building type it is as a museum, I think it ranks fairly high. And the reason is it's a much smaller museum than most U.S. museums. As a matter of fact, it had a very modest budget, less than $20 million. Museums now routinely cost $100 million plus to create. So it's a jewel box. So I would rank it as one of the best looking and best executed small museums in the United States.
And it's best looking because that column has a lot to do with
sure
why
does.
It looks so good.
But there's a backstory to that too, because Mario actually didn't want the column originally. But he came to believe that it was the right thing, not because magically he expected his upper floor to be supported on air. We did convince him that the only way to make this project cost what it did would be put a column there. Once he accepted that, and he did readily, the column became a part of the design. And we all think for the better. And I think Mario does too.
Yeah.
But you can imagine this big slab of terracotta floating 45 feet above the ground. The column makes it look almost comical, circus-like. There's this thin little column holding up this great mass, which, again, is a very appealing aspect to great architectural design. There's mystery in it, but then you discover it, and you ask questions, and you feel good about it.
You know, in fact, when you come to the exhibition, one of the buildings featured, of course, is the Beckler itself. And as part of the display, you have a number of different versions in Mario's own hand as to what that column might have looked like. And believe me, they are dramatically different one from the other. But what I think is most telling about that column, and yeah, it could be read as comical, and you know, it's got all kinds of nicknames now, just like the Firebird does. You know, it's this gigantic, you know, sweet potato or whatever it is you want to call it. But it really looks like a plastic element that is bulging in its center because it's holding this huge weight from above it. And believe me, that's an exaggeration of a classical norm known as entasis or entasis, which is how the ancient Greeks figured out how to make the gentlest swelling in their columns to actually rectify the optical illusions we all engage when we look at those very sober, mathematically correct, and hugely inspiring Greek temples. So it's out of that long tradition because, in fact, Mario, and he talks about this in the catalog, and it's a part of the exhibition. He'll talk about it Saturday night when he gives his lecture at the museum. He is just part of a long train of great architects going back to ancient Greece and Rome, and it pulls all the way into the 20th century with the great Philadelphia architect Louis Kahn and, of course, the Swiss-French architect Le Corbusier and their works by both of these architects in the exhibition. So he is very much aware of our shared history, our sense of community, and those elements are reflected in this building in nuanced ways, to be sure, and the better you get to know a building, a great building, the more you come to understand the way that architecture does work.
So the other building that Mario Botta is responsible for in the United States is the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. It looks very different from the Beckler. It's much bigger, first of all, but it does have a distinguishing feature. Like the Beckler's column, it has – I'm not sure how to describe this.
An oculus.
An oculus.
A window at the top of the building.
Enormous at the top of the building, which I'm assuming allows light into the center of the building. But that becomes the focal point from the exterior. Is that – something that's unique to him, or is that something that is just unique to that's in good architecture everywhere?
Well, not necessarily in good architecture everywhere. There are lots of ways to get light in a building, but I think that his truncated column, which he uses as a skylight, is a unique Mario Botta feature. He's used it on a number of projects, and I think what it does is it's a focal. It draws your eye to the center of that building, and then from there you look down. So again, I think what John was saying a moment ago. There's a sense of humor in the way Mario designs buildings as well as the seriousness of purpose in which he approaches it. And I think this is evidenced in these two buildings in the U.S.
Aside from function, how should architecture work in an urban setting?
There are two ways it can work. Certain buildings need to stand out as landmarks and say, you know, we're here, this is a point of reference, and the rest of them should stand back and be the framers of space that we use.
And who makes that decision?
Well, once upon a time, there was communal agreement both in society and within building and architecture that there was a common language and some limitations in building technology when you could only build in stone. You know, you could only do certain things, and you couldn't bring materials from a long way away. And so that sort of pleasing uniformity, what we call context, it's the background. In jargon, it's urban fabric, texture. That's what that architect that you mentioned at the beginning of the show said doesn't exist, because we tore all that down. We used to have it. Charlotte used to – just look at the old photographs. We had it in spades.
You're going to make Dan Morrill very angry, but okay, go ahead.
Well, he should be angry that we tore it all down.
No, he says we haven't, but go ahead.
When you enter the city, I was with a German industrialist, one time, taking me around. He said, "This is all so new." That was the biggest thing. It was all new. No sense of history. Now, what architects like Mario Botta are able to do through their talent and awareness is to bring little hints of history back.
Uh-huh.
And, that sense of awareness is, sort of filtering its way back into our profession and, I think, into the general sort of consciousness. So American cities have far too long been a circus ring of competing acts. We've got jugglers over here. We've got the elephant over there. We've got the tiger behind us. They're all competing. And what we are beginning to get in this museum ensemble works perfectly is buildings coming together, being different, but sharing a common purpose. And that's David's point about the master plan, which is usually essential. A master plan which fixes the principles, takes care of the human scale, understands it's about space before form. It's not the shape of the object. It's the kind of space that we live in. That master plan can sort that out, and then great architects can add their unique contribution, which is exactly what Mario has done.
And when you look at that space, you've got the Mint Museum, which is elevated off the street. You have to climb stairs to get to the front door. It's white. You have the Knight Theater, which is tucked away behind the Beckler glass front. Then you've got the Beckler, which is this terracotta tile. It kind of stands out because of its color. How did Mario Botta arrive at that decision to make it terracotta?
Well, Mario actually designed the profile of the terracotta tile that's on the museum, and he has used it in some of his projects in Europe, primarily Switzerland and Italy. So it is a product that is actually manufactured in Italy. Unfortunately, we were not able to accommodate that in the United States. We had to find an alternative manufacturer. But it is a tile that acts as a rain screen. Let me try to make this as simple as possible. There is no mortar joint. When you look at a brick building, there's the brick and the concrete that holds it together, or the mortar that holds it together. In this case, the terracotta tiles are attached with a frame to the building. The building is waterproof. The water goes right through the tile where the joints are and drains off. It does two things. It makes the building look a lot lighter and more weightless because the mortar joint isn't there, which drives it to the ground. And secondly, the terracotta acts as a durable, enduring material in the manner in which it's attached to the building.
And as an insulator.
Yeah. Aside from his work being described around the world, because he has a lot of buildings in Switzerland and Italy and China.
Correct.
His work has been described as both classical and modern, but it's also been described as highly formal and monumental and designed to stand the test of time. The Bechler looks monumental, and I think partially because of that cantilever and the column, but not formal to me. It looks inviting and warm and fun.
Well, there's a very happy tension here, and let me go back first to something that David Walter said, and that is that a sense of scale doesn't always have anything to do with size. In other words, you can have very large buildings that still don't read as though they have much of a presence. And you can have small buildings like ours that really do make a fabulous statement. And the tension is that you've got this kind of heroic and muscular geometry. There's this kind of prismatic solidity to this building as it sits there at the edge of the sidewalk. And yet the center of it has been opened up and filled with light, and that makes it so inviting. And that's a remarkable architectural dynamic, to have both elements operate together so supremely well and convincingly.
You know, you cannot think of the Bechler without the piece that is its distinguishing feature, and that is the Niki de Saint-Phalle firebird statue out front. It is not part of the architecture, but in a way, it is. Is that part of the? Was that part of the master plan?
Well, there was always an idea that Andreas had that there would be something out on that corner, to be sure. And in fact, originally he was thinking it would be a fountain-like sculpture, not unlike what you would see at the Pompidou, you know, the most important modern art museum in all of Western Europe, where there is a large fountain outside, which is in fact done by Niki de Saint-Phalle and Jean Tinguely. So he was thinking of something like that from the beginning, but he had seen the Firebird when it was on display as part of a large exhibition in Atlanta at the Botanical Gardens, and he saw how people responded to it, and he became instantly.
They had it first.
It was traveling.
Send it back.
Sorry, and it was actually owned by a German couple, and so Andreas was so taken by the effect that the Firebird had on everybody he saw near it, he reached out to the Niki de Saint-Phalle Foundation. He asked if they would forward his interest to the current owners, who were anonymous. They did. The owners were intrigued. Andreas went and met them in Germany, convinced them of the importance of the city having this great work in front of the museum, and so he purchased it and placed it there. So two things. First, the connection between great sculpture and great architecture, this is a timeless notion. This goes back millennia. And so they've always been woven in these greatest examples. And so that's a given. But the other thing is, as Mario was saying the other day, great architecture can only happen when you have a great client. And I think when you have somebody like Andreas, as generous as he's been and as prescient, as foresightful as he always seems to be, that connection between that wonderful work of sculpture in the building, this is so much about him in a way that Andreas would never want to admit. In fact, if he's listening to the show, I am certain he is cringing at the very notion that we should be celebrating him this way. But it really happens because you have great clients. And I would say that communities end up with the architecture that they deserve. And I think the Bechler Museum is important because it may well help raise the bar.
We're going to talk about that, and we'll talk about the exhibit of his work on display through the 25th of July when we come back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Queen's University of Charlotte, offering 16 graduate programs. Registration for upcoming info sessions for communications, business, or interior design available at queens.edu. Well, it's Friday. That means the weekly news roundup comes your way at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, the National Hour. First, President Barack Obama takes his State of the Union message on the road. The House approves the Farm Bill, and the Fed continues its stimulus cut as Ben Bernanke's term ends as the head of the Fed. Just some of the stories and personalities they'll be talking about in 20 minutes. The International Hour follows at 11. Perhaps you have something to add to our conversation about architecture in Charlotte. WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks is the place to begin your participation, and we are coming right back.
Hi, I'm Rachel Martin, host of Weekend Edition Sundays, where we do not shy away from asking the big questions.
So the places where young women today can experience greater leadership typically are not within the Catholic Church.
Why is that? So,
I wish I knew.
Join me Sundays on Weekend Edition from NPR News and let the conversation begin.
Keep up with the news Saturday and Sunday mornings from 8 to 10. Weekend Edition on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about urban design and the contributions made by the cultural campus at the end of South Tryon Street uptown, particularly the Beckler Museum of Modern Art. They themselves are celebrating their own architect, Mario Botta, with a talk, I think, tomorrow night by the architect himself, mm-hmm. and also by a long-running exhibit within the museum, Architecture and Memory, Beckler Museum of Modern Art, January 31st through July 25th. The exhibit is called Architecture and Memory. Why the title?
Well, as we mentioned earlier, Mario, I think like so many other great architects, has a profound sense of history. I mean, he knows full well the rush through the millennia of all of the classical norms and all the extraordinary influences that inform all of us, whether we know it or not. But certainly as an architect who is self-aware, he has a great respect for architectural history and for the history of great cities.
Well, he says that architecture should act in the territory of memory because it is in this territory that a city grows.
Well, he's talking about the collective memory of every community, you know, having a sense of its own identity, which is usually defined by its history more than anything. And without that, it can be very hard, not impossible, but unusual to be able to see some sense of the future that has anything to do with that particular community. So that connection between history, the present, and the future is what very often defines great planning. The other thing that he would say, too, is that this is an exhibition that starts with a large gallery called Encounters. And there we have representative works from many of the different artists and writers and philosophers and photographers who had a profound influence on him. So again, the architects Louis Kahn and Le Corbusier, but also Picasso and Paul Klee and Henry Moore and Jean Tanguy and Nicky de Saint-Phalle and the photographer Robert Frank and the remarkable literary creature Dürrenmatt and even the art historian Rudolf Arnheim. So we have representative works from all of those figures at the very beginning of the exhibition, so that before you go in to see this fabulous series of commissions represented by over 200 objects, including 20 of the most exquisitely crafted architectural models you will ever see in your life, made out of pear wood in Italy. They are just absolutely astounding. Then you're prepared to appreciate the rest of the show, which focuses on museums, libraries, theaters, and sacred spaces, places
of worship. Which is what he's primarily designed over his career.
Well, you know, yes and no. I mean, like so many architects, his career starts with, you know, lots of single-family houses, which are fabulous. And now, of course, some of his biggest commissions, like in China, entire universities. Mm. But these four commissions were chosen because, you know, in our earliest conversations when the museum did open 4 years ago, we wanted to focus on those kinds of commissions that provide architecture of transformation. That is to say that you enter one kind of person and you leave a profoundly different kind of person because in part the architectural experience that you've had.
That brings me to this. Take us back, David Walters, to prior to the onset of the Green and the Radcliffe and this complex. Describe South Tryon Street in the 1980s.
Well, I
and be gentle.
Well, I mean, I arrived here. My wife and I arrived in 1990, not knowing anything about the city at all. Mm-hmm. And of course, we went. I had my job interview downtown, and you know, what I saw was what you're alluding to. There was nothing to see.
I think there was a Goodyear tire store on the corner.
Yes, there were actually a row of rather pleasant, you know, average 2-3-story brick buildings, all empty, boarded up. And you'll remember this, Mike, when the city hosted the Final Four, which I think was 1994-ish, that they had to erect false facades all the way, almost on the blocks where we are talking about.
Right, exactly right.
Yeah, sort of a Potemkin village of instant bars and restaurants, because we had nothing there at all. There were some very nice buildings. There was an old building called the Jack Woods Building, which was beautiful, which was torn down. It's been a parking lot ever since.
Yeah, old clothing store.
Yeah, and there was a heritage of valuable building stock. And if we could get into the time machine, we would have only selectively taken out some of that, refurbished a lot of it, but left sites for new buildings, because a continual process, you know, building the future, connecting it back to the past, is what European cities have, just because European cities are big and old. And, you know, it's the lack of history which we have, you know, sort of become aware of here. We had it, we lost it, we're trying to find it again. And what I love about this South Tryon area is building great quality new stuff without mimicking the past. It's respectful to the past, mm-hmm. but it's not putting, you know, columns, impediments, and things on, because that would be fake.
But some might ask, and I know why this happened. It was because of the vision of Ed Crutchfield and Pat Mumford and people like that, and the fact that they put their money where their ideas were to build, to create this cultural campus. But some might say, why not spread the wealth throughout the rest of the city? Why does everything have to be clustered? Well, we know the answer to this because of Bank of America and First Union. On North Tryon and South Tryon, why can't it be scattered down Caldwell Street or out to, you know, Second Street or something? Why is everything in one place?
Well, it can, and I think that it will. In the fullness of time, mm-hmm. I think a community looks at moments like this one and they are inspired and want to try to do more of the same. When they see something work, smart people want to replicate the strengths that make something so advantageous. And, you know, it's a matter of patience. City building doesn't happen overnight. And I think it also takes leadership. It takes leadership in terms of capital. It takes leadership in terms of politics. And it takes a vision.
And do we have that now in the absence of people like Ed Crutchfield and like Hugh McCall? Do we have that?
Well, I would say it may not matter. I think that Charlotte has been a little impatient about recreating its urban center, which is okay. I mean, we're a go-go city. I came here in the early 1970s, and things really began to take off, as you know, when Hugh McCall became president, then chairman of the bank, and Ed Crutchfield the same. That tension between those two banks mm-hmm. created, in effect, where we are today. Now, I don't want to speak for either one of them, but they would tell you that the next generation of leadership just doesn't necessarily have to pick up the baton, but they have to see what's happened and allow those kinds of things to continue to grow. And I don't think it necessarily means particular leadership. I think it means a balance between public and private leadership to address these things.
When David Walters, you and I have talked about urban design and urban planning and the end of suburbs and what's going to happen to suburbs in the next 40 years, et cetera, we have always had people who write in, call in, et cetera, and say, well, you know, I never go downtown. I don't understand why all this focus on downtown. I never go downtown. Why do we need a central city? I want my picket fence and my brick house. Leave me alone. Mario Botta is actually a good architect to talk about when you talk about the importance of architecture and when you talk about cities, because he believes in cities. He says that cities are the most beautiful, intelligent, flexible, and cultured model of human aggregation that history has ever created. Wow.
It's a long project. I mean, you know, as has just been said, that I mean, European cities have a long history. We go there and admire, oh, there's something over here, there's something over there. That's arrived over centuries. And I do think the long lens here that, I mean, it's significant that, you know, Center City Partners in the city are now actively looking at the North Tryon area. Mm-hmm. Because that's not holding up. You know, that's now second class to the South Tryon area.
Yep.
So this competition, this healthy competition combined with civic boosterism, with a sense that that we can be really the leading city in the Southeast. We're not as big as Atlanta, but we handle snow better. And
it doesn't take much, by the way.
Our family in the Northeast are just laughing at us, you know, totally laughing at us down in the South.
But
eventually we will get things spread out. The university is invested in, you know, their new building, which will become a campus in the next 15, 20 years. North Tryon area, there's some vacant sites. I know, David, you're well aware of the development potential of half a dozen sites.
Correct.
That, given a good economy, 10, 15 years, we'll get a new assemblage up there, and then the Levine properties in First Ward, they'll develop, and so we will get this thickness in the city. Mm-hmm. And for the guy in the suburbs who wants to, you know, keep his sort of picket fence, that's fine, but he needs to realize that without a thriving center city, with all the tax revenue that is generated, without that, his property taxes are going to go sky high. Center City subsidizes the suburbs.
Botha also believes in iconic buildings, and the Beckler is an iconic building. Mm-hmm. And I remember years ago, this is long before I worked here, having conversations about downtown Charlotte. And I think there was the owner of Jonathan's, which is the building right next to where we're sitting right now, who put forth the idea that Charlotte needed an iconic landmark. I think one of the things he thought about advocating for was a Space Needle, not unlike Seattle, but that says Seattle. You have the Eiffel Tower, which says Paris. You have Big Ben, which says London. You have the Washington Monument. You have the Empire State Building. Except for the Empire State Building, all of those things are tourist attractions. but this is an iconic building, and it gives Charlotte a sense of place. I mean, will this building someday be notable as a Charlotte landmark?
Absolutely. It'll be notable as a landmark in the United States, if not further. But just to go back a second to the iconic building, that tower was actually envisioned to be done by Taliesin Associate Architects, which is the legacy of Frank Lloyd Wright, so he was clearly thinking icon. Mm-hmm. But as you know, icon, I guess, by dictionary definition, means a particular style or a particular idea. And if you wanted to say, is the Botha's building an iconic building? Yes, it is, particular to his style of doing architecture. There's no question about that. But iconic buildings are difficult to list. Now, you could say the Chrysler Building, as an example, in New York, is an iconic skyscraper. But our modern skyscrapers tend not to be iconic because they're done in a certain style and they're repetitive. So we enter into a design idea and then we repeat it.
Could it be argued that the Duke Energy Building, which was to have been the Wachovia headquarters, because of that, whatever you call that bridge across the top of the building and the LED lighting down the side, that becomes a landmark iconic building?
Absolutely, because it has a stunning profile. So you could say it's iconic in the sense that the profile creates a design or a shape that is unique to that building.
You know, and I would say, too, the same can be said and should be said of the Bank of America Tower by Cesar Pelli, which is, frankly, one of the best tall buildings in my mind in the entire country, and Charlotte's lucky to have that, too. You know, the one thing that I would argue as well is that the whole conversation in the end is really about expectations of quality. And I think for this city to get where it wants to get, you need to have clients who expect more out of their architects, and you need to have architects who expect more out of their clients. I think you need to have planning review boards that are made up of people who actually know something about design and architecture and history, in the same way that for public art, you should have commissions that actually have people who know something about art and the way that artists live and what constitutes great public art. So if we want to...
Do we have that here in either case?
Well, and again, just speaking for myself, not institutionally, not nearly as much as we should, and I'll just be frank about it. Okay. If you want to raise the bar, raise the quality of everybody involved, set higher expectations. By the way, that chilling description of Charlotte that you started the show with was by Robert A.M. Stern. And the last museum building that I had the chance to oversee get built was designed by Bob. So I got this coming and going, Mike, I'm telling you right now. And he is absolutely right. But it's all about expectations of quality and to not value engineer yourself into some lower level of life.
Joey on Facebook says, my favorite building was the old Duke Power building with the brick banks underneath. And Bill from Matthews echoes your sentiment about the ersatz nightlife that we created for the Final Four many years ago. And he points out that Charlotte's a vibrant city with breathtaking views both distant and near, from I-77 north approaching the city to the long view coming in from the Matthews area on Independence to the awesome ride around 277. What I find missing, he says, is any significant signage welcoming people to Charlotte as they approach the city. Welcome to Charlotte, the city of the New South. One question, what does your panel think the city landscape will look like in 5 years?
Well, there is something that I'm not sure many people know about, but the Department of Transportation, not the Charlotte DOT, I don't think, but there's an idea to put up concrete sound walls around I-277, to cut the noise of the traffic for adjacent areas, which would mean that you would drive around 277 and not see the city. You'd see concrete walls.
Right. Yes.
That has to be the dumbest and the most stupid idea that anybody has thought of for quite some time.
And who came up with that?
I'm not going to point any fingers, but it comes out of transportation engineers trying to be sensitive about the noise. But it's this idea that you got one problem, you find a solution for the one problem and cause a gazillion other problems. So anybody who's got any influence, please don't build those walls. That would be the biggest disaster for the Charlotte townscape.
But clearly, somebody somewhere in the structure of power in the city, be it political or business, has learned from what you people have created on South Tryon.
I would say absolutely. The South Tryon complex, Levine Center, is well-recognized, well-respected, appreciated by everybody top to bottom in this community. I mean, all you need to do is go down in front of the Beckler any day of the week, that's 7 days a week, and watch people photographing
the Firebird.
The Firebird and folks in front of it. I mean, let me add one thing about my three notions.
I'm not sure you have time.
No time.
I think we're done.
All right, we're finished.
David Wagner, principal of Wagner Murray Architects, who helped build the building. John Boyer, president of the Beckler Museum of Modern Art, and David Walters, professor of urban design in the College of Arts and Architecture at UNC Charlotte. Thank you all for the hour.